My name's Chris. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chris.
It's good to be here. Good to be here tonight. This, this meeting means a lot to me. It was kind of an offshoot of my old home group, the Spiritual Awakenings Group in Burnsville. I'm actually in the process of starting back up, which is kind of cool. It laid dormant for about 8 years. But anyway, if you just come in here tonight for the first time, what Dave and I are going to be doing is we're talking about the original manuscript. The original manuscript is the first draft of what became the Big Book. And why I think it's important to study that, why I think it's interesting at least to study that, is because that's what the alcoholics, that's what the alcoholics produced. Bill and Akron in New York hammered out the original manuscript. Then it was sent to a number of different people who gave editing recommendations. It went to Catholic priests. It went to editors. It went around to different people because they wanted to make sure there was nothing in it that was going to upset anybody. And they also knew that they weren't really writers. So there's a number of changes that were made in between the original manuscript and the Big Book as we see it today. I'm not saying the Big Book or the original manuscript is better than the Big Book or anything. I make no judgment about that. I just think it's interesting to hear the exact language that the alcoholics put together because it's an expression of what the groups really were doing and what they thought about recovery and their experiences. So Dave and I started this workshop about 8 years ago or something, right? That's a long time ago. But it's been interrupted, a couple of times. And so this is the third time we've sat at this table. And we're now on step 11, finally. But that's what tonight is about. We're going to be reading from the original manuscript and sharing some of our experience, strength, and hope. And if it sounds like we're reading the wrong book, it's because, there's different language in different places in this than what you might be used to in the Big Book. Anyway.
Page 86 in the fourth edition. That's a big book.
They're talking about prayer and meditation. Now, I want to explain just a little bit about what it looked like in the early days when they were writing this book. Before this book was written, they were more aligned with the Oxford group than really had established themselves as Alcoholics Anonymous. Both Akron and New York, when they first started, they started in Oxford groups. And then the alcoholics kind of moved to the side to get away from the civilians. And they had their own thing, but it was still very Oxford group-esque. And how the Oxford group would do meditation is they would always do morning meditation. And a lot of them did it with their families. And Bill changed a lot of the dynamics of the Oxford group morning meditation. And, I think probably for the better. But how the Oxford group would do it is they would all sit in a living room or something, and they would read a spiritual passage from the Bible or some other spiritual piece of literature, and then they would get quiet. And they had a pen and a notebook while they were quiet, and if what they considered was a guided thought came into their head, like, go bring Aunt Fanny a fruit basket. They would write down, go give Aunt Fanny a fruit basket. And they would write down these guided thoughts. And then at the end, they would share these with each other. And they would put them up against the four absolutes, which were absolute honesty, absolute purity, absolute unselfishness, and absolute love. And if going to bring Aunt Fanny a fruit basket measured up to those four absolutes, Aunt Fanny would get a fruit basket. They would consider that was the voice of God through intuition. They were trying to seek the actual voice and will of God in these meditations. And within these meditations in the beginning and at the end, there was a lot of prayer work as well. And they would spend, 20 minutes to an hour every morning, getting with God before they would start their day, as the Oxford Group practice. Now remember, we split off from the Oxford Group, so we brought some of this stuff with us. And Bill embellished and Bill changed a little bit of stuff, and Bill made it more alcoholic friendly, and that's all to the good, but you know, sometimes it helps to know from whence we came. So we're going to start on the paragraph where it says, when we retire at night. When we retire at night, we constructively review our day. Constructively, I think, is an important word in this. It's a constructive self-examination. I believe a lot of the step work points us toward self-examination. We need to really look at our behavior. We need to really look at our motives. We need to look at a lot of things about ourselves, because it's very important that we practice spiritual principles and make an effort to become better people. It's more conducive to long-term sobriety if you're working on becoming a better person, you know, asking God for help, trying to practice spiritual principles. So we constructively review our day. And we ask ourselves, were we resentful? Were we selfish? Were we dishonest? Or were we afraid? You know, were we? And if you'll remember 7.5 years ago when we went over the fourth step, the four step has a lot to do with that. The four step has a lot to do. You do a fear inventory. You do a resentment inventory. You do a conduct inventory. So selfishness and dishonesty are examined in multiple ways in this inventory. So we're learning to apply the steps that we've already learned in the four step, in both the 10th and the 11th step. Now, resentment, you know, why do we need to look at our resentment? Let me tell you, I was in a meeting a couple of days ago where someone was talking about justified resentments, and they were talking about, you know, well, if somebody really does something really bad, you know, I consider that a justified resentment. I want to tell you right now, there are no justified resentments. There are only fatal ones if you're alcoholic. There are only fatal ones. We need to find a way to get past the resentment. Now, are we going to get angry? Somebody backs into my new car in the parking lot, you'll see somebody really angry, okay? But resentment is being angry 7 years later about the, you know what I mean? Still trying to find the guy and get even. That type of stuff is incredibly corrosive to our spiritual condition. And we need to maintain our spiritual condition. There's practices that we need to apply to maintain our spiritual condition. That's the effort that we need to put into this recovery thing. Selfishness. Selfishness, I believe alcoholism is a toxic expression of selfishness. I think we come in here so selfish we don't even think we're selfish. Everything revolves around us. The way we see things is better than the way other people see things. You know, you want my opinion on that? You know, I might be able to help you out by sharing my opinion on that. And we have problems with employers. You know, we're always in collision with people in families. And it comes from this bedrock foundation of selfishness that we have as an attribute of alcoholism. I don't believe you can be alcoholic without being toxically selfish. That's just, I've never seen somebody who, you know, didn't see the entire world from a selfish point of view. So what do we need to do? We need to inventory this. We need to recognize it. And one of the first things that'll happen if you get a good sponsor is they'll start asking you to do unselfish things. Pick up the chairs, make coffee, you know, help the new guy. You know what I mean? Don't share for 20 minutes in a meeting that's not a speaker meeting. you know, you get these lessons from sponsors about just how selfish you are, hopefully if they're honest sponsors. And we need to really look at this. And one of the things that I found in my life, which really came as a surprise to me, was there was I was so selfish. This was what I would do. I would come to in the morning. I'd make it to my terrible job and drive in my terrible car, you know, with the license plate that didn't match the registration, that didn't match the insurance, you know. You get all three of those, Dave, that's the trifecta. Anyway, I would get to work and I'd be pissed at my boss because it'd be a crappy job. And, you know, here I am, I'm an electrician. I don't know anything about electrical work. I'm an electrician. I'm blowing stuff up and, you know, I'm yelling at everybody and I'm angry. And I drive right to the liquor store from work and I'd buy a bottle of vodka. I'd go home. The phone would be off. I wouldn't open my mail. Leave me alone. I'm drinking. And I would drink myself into unconsciousness and I'd wake up the next day and I'd do it over again. I want to tell you, I thought I wasn't hurting anybody but myself. That's how I thought when I came in here. But what I just described to you is the most selfish type of person in the world because I was not available for anybody with that type of a lifestyle. Anybody that would have needed me. Any way I could have bettered other people's lives was completely off the table because I was drinking. And that's unbelievably selfish. So, I had to come in here and I had to start recognizing this selfishness. And you do it in inventory, you do it with your sponsor yelling at you. And here's the thing that's really surprising about my life. I went from that guy who didn't have 5 minutes for anybody, to I can't even count the ways in my life today that I'm helpful to other people. And it was an organic change. You know, because of practicing these principles, I organically changed into somebody who's running around all over the planet trying to help other people, not just in AA. Less in AA than I used to. More, you know, in society and stuff like that. You look at my life, and there's purpose. There's purpose to it, and that was an organic change that happened through, you know, self-examination and application of these principles. Dishonest, I still have some dishonesty, but it's not the kind of dishonesty I used to have. My dishonesty now is it's below the horizon. Like picture an iceberg, okay? There's like 20% of the iceberg is sticking up. That was the type of dishonesty you would have known I was dishonest when I first came in here. Now you're not going to be able to recognize it because my dishonesty looks like I hold back information. You know, that's how I'm dishonest. I'll hold back information. I won't flat out lie to you. I just won't give you the information that you really deserve to have. I'm not completely transparent. And I'm working on that. I'm working on that hard with my wife right now. Afraid. I talked about this last week. I didn't understand what they meant by afraid. I thought being afraid was being a coward. Trust me, I was not a coward. I was complete lunatic insane. You know, I had no, I didn't worry at all about dying. You know, I was not a coward, but I had a level of anxiety and uncomfortability that would wrap around me in a sober state where I couldn't do the things that I needed to do to be able to have a life of purpose. You know, I wasn't going to go back to school because I don't like people giving me homework. You know what I mean? I'm not going to try to get a better job because this one's bad enough. Why do I want to work harder than this? You know, I mean, since I was a kid, you know, crowds of people and bright lights and police and all this stuff, I just wanted out. I wanted you to leave me alone, and I wanted out. And I really had to drink to be able to break away from that anxiety that kept me from being able to step out easy. You know what I mean? Remember, you drink a half a quart of whiskey and you'd step out easy, you know? You had the confidence. Like I was using this booze to feel normal. So was I afraid? I had self-centered fear wrapped on me like a wet coat. And I had to start looking at this stuff. And I had to start being okay, doing what I needed to do, and passing through that fear. My whole first year sober, it was an ordeal for me to get out of the car, go to the church, walk down the stairs, and go sit in a meeting. It was an ordeal for me because I was uncomfortable doing it. I'd have rather been home watching TV. You know, so this fear will kill me if I don't find a way to overcome it. We outgrow fear with the practice of these principles. That's one of the promises in this book. Do I owe an apology? Now, I never used to apologize for anything. It was a sign of weakness. But what happens when I do something wrong and I hurt somebody and I don't apologize is it sticks with me. It sticks with me. And I'm always thinking about it. And I'm always, you know, oh, yeah, that, you know, geez, I did that. I've learned the hard way that making an apology quickly is the way to have real peace and serenity in my life. It's just peace and serenity in my life are much more important to me today than being right. You know what I mean? I always had to be right. I had to be right about everything. I was holding on to everything. And I was being right about everything. And I was miserable. So today, look, if I owe an apology, you know, you're probably going to get it unless I'm oblivious to the harm. Have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person at once? Another thing I learned in my first fifth step is if I've got things I'm ashamed of, if I've got things that, you know, cause me discomfort when they come into my mind, one of the best things in the world is to share that with somebody. Share that with somebody who has experience with these steps. It's sponsor, spiritual advisor, good friend in AA, whatever. Share these things because it's a way of becoming free of them. I had so much crap in my head when I got here that was just haunting me and crushing my spirit. I've learned that by sharing these things, I can break free of them. You know, I don't care anymore. I'm not attached anymore to how what I believe you think of me. You know what I mean? Like, that used to be so important to me. Oh my God, you know, I might look stupid. I'm unattached to that for the most part today. It's a different relationship I have with, you know, the rest of the world. And that comes from, you know, being just constantly releasing this stuff. Were we kind and loving toward all? You know, this is not one that I say yes to very often. You know, but it's something I should be asking myself. Think about this for a second. In the third step, we make a decision that God is going to be the Father. Okay? Now, if God is the Father, what makes you? What's the relationship that I have with you? Wouldn't it make you my brothers and sisters? You know, am I kind and loving toward all? It's hard sometimes because there's stupid people, you know, and there's annoying people. But you know what? At least what I've learned is this, you know, just shut up. I've at least learned that much, but I'm way more kind and loving toward all than I used to be. I completely ignored you in the past. Now, I think I said this last week. There was a guy whose sponsor said to him, "Hey, you know those shadowy figures that you see, like, you know, wandering around? Those are actually other people." he was giving a good lesson. What could we have done instead? What could we have done better? This is a good exercise for us. How could I have handled that situation? I kind of screwed up that meeting today at work. or, you know, I there was a newcomer at the meeting, I didn't even say hi to him, you know. What could I have done better? And let's try to do it better, you know, with God's help the next time. Were we thinking of ourselves most of the time? Or were we thinking of what we could do for others, of what we could pack into the stream of life? Remember, when I first came in here, all I thought about was myself and how things would impact me. You know, today, a lot of the time, I'm thinking about how they would impact you. What can I bring to a meeting? Instead of going to a meeting like it's a spiritual filling station, you know, and dumping all my crap, how about if I go to a meeting and try to bring a message of depth and weight, of experience, strength, and hope? You know, that's just an example. What can I pack into the stream of life? I didn't understand this for a long time. I understand this today. My life is busy. And when there's free time in my life, it usually I get involved in something that's productive. I put a lot of effort into my life today, where all I could do was barely get through a bad 8 hours of work back in the day, besides drinking. You know, today it's I wish there was more time. But we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. We come in here a lot of times with self-pity. Just that wonderful self-pity that we can just wallow in. You know, I'm a victim. That really, we're going to move from that, hopefully, away from the worry, the remorse, the morbid reflection. There's been things that have hit my life in the last 10 years that would have crippled me when I was drinking. And I got through them in a pretty smooth way because, you know, I'm a recovered alcoholic and I'm practicing spiritual principles. I had deaths of parents, divorces, losses of jobs, near bankruptcies. I had all that stuff. And, you know, I walked through that stuff with a fair amount of dignity and being able to sleep very soundly every night. You know, so I know this stuff works, and you don't want to worry, have morbid reflection, and a lot of remorse, because it will diminish your usefulness to others. It'll take away time that you could be using in a more constructive way. After making our review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. That's a prayer directive. When it says something like that, If you want to thoroughly follow our path, that's a prayer directive, and you're supposed to do that. So, you know, God, forgive me for my defects of character, and where, you know, forgive me for falling short today of spiritual ideals. Please show me the way to correct these things and to grow in understanding and effectiveness to better do thy will. You know, that's just an example of, you know, the type of prayer you're supposed to throw out there. Right, Dave?
I usually read the Snapple Cap. That's usually, they got some good stuff in there, and that's what I kind of like. I center my spiritual life around whatever I read there.
That's good, too. The Children's Bible is also pretty good. Reading
too advanced for me. Hi, everyone. My name is David Palmer. I'm a grateful recovered alcoholic. You know, it's really very cool when people celebrate. And, you know, we do it once a quarter here in Westfield. And you know, it reminds me that, you know, of two things that are important to me. One is that time doesn't mean anything, right? And the other is that time is the only thing that we can never get back, right? And, you know, I got sober in 85, that's not my sobriety date, you know, and... You know, I've looked back. I spent the vast majority of my time sober since '85. But you know, I've had a lot of reflections in my life the last couple of years. My life has changed fairly dramatically, and I'm very pleased. And it's nothing that I did. It's just the way that this thing kind of unfolded. But you know, I came here. You know, I've been coming here for a long time, and you know, I met Patty Allen, and you know, she showed up one day and you know, just kind of with her bright forever smile. Come on. It's got to be problems at home. Can't you at least show us that? Anyway. Yeah, you always think people who are smiling all the time have brain damage, right? I mean, it's like my first sponsor was always happy. It made me sick. And, you know, over a period of time, I got to know Patty Allen, and I got to love and respect her for a variety of reasons. You know, and the funny thing was, she was getting a new apartment. She was getting a new apartment, and I had a couch that I was, you know, we had had for years, and it was time to move on because we were redoing the basement. I said, "Would you like the couch?" And she's like, "Yeah, sure." I said, "Okay, great." Now, here's an interesting thing. Apparently, something happened because we brought that couch down into the basement through the stairs, but it did not want to leave the same way that it came in. It did not fit. It had grown over the years. I don't know how that happened. Or the house shrunk. I don't know why that was. It was four alcoholics bathed in sweat, cursing me along with me until we actually had to knock a corner off the room. So this charitable event that I'm hoping to do is where I get a couch to somebody who actually wants it is turning into this giant free-for-all. And I thought, okay, well, we got it out of the house. Finally out of the house, right? What could possibly go wrong now? We bring it over to Patty Allen's place and goddamn couch won't fit in the stairs very well going up to her apartment. And we ended up knocking off this giant sign from the ceiling that says, you know, exit no couches or something like that. I forget what it said. And we knocked it and it was like, just shattered it. And I'm like, oh, we probably shouldn't tell anybody about that. You know, and it ended up in Patty Allen's apartment just where it was supposed to be. You know, and I said, you know, you may want to just abandon this if you ever leave this apartment. Just leave it where it is. But the funny thing about this is that, you know, this idea about watching Karen and you know, the other celebrants tonight reminded me of just how little time we actually get, you know, on this ride and just how important every moment is. And I would not have felt that way if I had not involved myself in spiritual matters that other alcoholics hadn't brought to my attention, such as the 11th step. I would not have gotten into this mindset, right, of wanting to be helpful to others if it hadn't been pointed out to me that that was the one thing that I never did, right? I never really kind of put anybody's, you know, feelings at stake. And that wasn't the way that I was raised, and that wasn't the way I was before I started drinking. And I started drinking at 12, but before that, I was always concerned about everybody else, right? And I'll never forget this. One day, I was supposed to have a play date at my house, which was kind of unusual because we were poor and we didn't tend to invite people to our house. I usually went out to their house. And the fellow who was coming over was like 15 minutes late. And my mom goes, "Oh, you know, Gary's 15 minutes late." And I thought to myself, you can be late? Because I was so uptight and white, like you had to be there on time. Like you couldn't ever, you know, cause somebody to wait for you. I'm like, well, wow, that's really wild. You could actually inconvenience people. I had no idea. And it was literally that moment that I started to inconvenience people. And I started to become selfish. And I think I drank like right after that too. I don't know if there's any correlation there. But, you know, the funny thing was when I came into the rooms, I, like Chris so elegantly said, I had no idea how selfish I was. I really had no idea. In fact, it would be, I think, close to 2 years before one day I went to myself, I did what? You ever say that to yourself? Oh my God, I did that to somebody. Like, I actually did that, like, and this, in this case, it was my mom. Like, oh my God. And then I had children, and they started doing it to me. I'm like, yeah, mom. I went over to my mom's house. I said, yeah, I just wanted to let you know, like, it's happening to me now, and I'm really sorry about that. You know, when you don't come home until later, or you don't come home at all, you know, and somebody who loves you is worried about you. I never gave that a bit of mind because I was out doing my deal, you know. Drinking requires a lot of energy, money, time. It's an investment, you know. It's like an artisan, right? You learn how to imbibe in a certain way so that you completely fall apart when there's nobody on the street, right? And that's it. You know, it's a craft that I had developed, so it took a lot of time and energy. This understands, that started to unfold. I don't know about you guys, but like when you start to get the reality starts to hit you, you ever reel backwards and like spin backwards and go, whoa, wait, I cannot go down that spiritual path. That's just way too much information. I could not have been that horrible. And then you go, okay, so I would do that, and I kind of hang out for a while, like I was hanging out on an island, right, waiting for it to get better over there. And then I start down the path again, start working, you know, with people a little bit more, and then you find a new kind of thing that you did. It kind of pops up in your memory, you go, oh, shit, You know, and each and every time that happens, or happened to me, I would recognize that as God finally realized I was ready to have that experience with that event that happened in the past. You know, you shot somebody. Yeah, it's not a great thing. You know, you stabbed somebody. That's not a great thing. You know, those things were always, the things that kind of weighed heavily on my mind. But here's the funny thing. The thing that followed me the longest, stayed in my head, and almost killed me were the things I didn't talk about. Right? Now, there may be somebody sitting in this room right now thinking, I'm never going to talk about that. And there was stuff that I did that I was never going to talk about. And, you know, one of the great things about Alcoholics Anonymous is that if you come around to these rooms long enough, you will hear everything that you didn't want to talk about. Right? Now, in the stuff that Chris said, it says, have we kept something to ourselves which should be discussed with another person at once? I was, I got remanded to a psychiatric hospital due to a variety of issues outside of my control. I mean, I tried to set fire to a police officer. That was outside of my control.
They
hate that. And do you know there's apparently a law against that? Unbelievable. What will they think of next? And, you know, and I was in this locked unit, and the choice was prison or recovery. Prison or recovery. Prison or recovery. That was a hard choice, right? That's a hard choice. But I knew it was my only shot, my only way to get out, and I got out, and they gave me my $110,000 big book and said, don't drink and go to meetings. And I had that sinking feeling because I had all this stuff in my head that I had never talked about, where I knew that I could not do that. I mean, that was the thing that I couldn't do. That's why you locked me up, right? And now you're telling me after all that insurance money, I just go out and do that thing that I can't do, and that was terrifying. You know, so I became the guy I went to meetings. But at 90 days, to celebrate my 90 days, I went out and used some non-conference approved products. And and the funny thing was, you know, it did the exact same thing to my body that it had always done, but it did not change my perception. And it was on that night that I said, I've come here, I've always wanted a perception change. Wanted a perception change about what was around me. And I said, I can't do this. I can't go back. And I was facing real time in prison. And I'm like, I can't do this. I can't do this. And I had this kind of awakening moment. And I came back to the meetings the next day and I raised my hand when they asked, like, you know, who's on a day count? And I raised my hand and said, I'm Dave and I have 91 days. Right? Because I had absolutely no intention of talking about this. Mm-hmm. I had none. You know, and I had a reason for that. There's always a reason for a lie. You ever have a good reason that goes with a good lie? Right? I can tell you. Mine was, the statute of limitations has not run out on my shit, and I do not want to start copping to the truth while I'm here. And I'm going to tell you something. That if you have some version of that, it's going to be a tough haul. I didn't talk about that for 17 years. You know what it's like when you're at your home group where you're the guy? I mean, I used to make the coffee, and when I made the coffee at my home group, I had a can of Bustelo, you know, Cuban coffee, and a can of regular coffee, and they'd be like, you guys are going to have fun tonight, you know? Pour those two in there, and people would be like, this is great coffee, Dave. Where'd you make it? Where'd you get it from? How was it? I was voted best coffee maker of the year. But when it came to celebrate a year and I got my coin, I knew I only had 9 months. When I spoke at my five-year anniversary, I knew I only had 4 years and 9 months. And, you know, no matter how good of a liar you guys are, and I know how good of a liar you guys are, that wears thin after a while. I'm starting to watch people have real spiritual awakenings around me. You know, I'm starting to watch people have an experience with God and with the rooms, and I wanted what you guys had. But now, you know, that prison thing is over. You know, I made it through the probation or the probation, and I'm good, and I'm not going to go to prison, and I should talk about that now. But when you're claiming you got 5 years, you don't want to talk about that. See, I had a new reason, right? And it didn't start at 1 year. Someone said to me, "Hey, Dave, do you remember that time that you banged heroin in your neck with the turkey baster? You should probably talk about that." No, it started that night, right? Like in a nightly review. Do we have something that we need to discuss with somebody immediately? And then as time went by, and time went by, and time went by, it became the lie that I lived. I'm not going to give that up. Of course I'm not sponsored, and of course I'm not doing inventory, because that would be inconvenient to the lie. My alcoholism doesn't like to be inconvenienced. It doesn't like to have this reality set in that conflicts with the reality that I've created, which is not actually reality, right? It's like a reality show. It's a ruination theme, right? Alcoholism for me is a ruination theme. I will find a new and unique way, quote unquote unique, that means you've all done it yourselves, right? To try to kill myself, to put an end to who I am, to make this unreasonable to come back. You know, I was the guy who did everything in the rooms for the first 5 years. The next 5 years I turned that practice over to others, you know, and I would hang out but not do as much. And in the next 5 years, going into year 15, I was too busy to come here. Right? For those of you who've got some time, you may have found yourselves occasionally finding yourself too busy to attend meetings, or you've moved and it's inconvenient. Or I moved to Westfield and had an instant resentment against the meeting that was in this room, which is why I started a meeting in this room. Right? I'll fix them. Anyway, you know, this idea, right, that I should discuss something with somebody else at once was not in the forefront of my mind for those years. And what ended up happening, of course, was that I went out and drank, right? And I like to remind myself that, you know, some people have these kind of wonderful moments where they go out and they're at a wonderful party or something, and they have a drink somehow, and it's not so bad. Me, I got a hooker and a bottle of white wine, and she robbed me, and I got drunk. Just, you know, come on. Couldn't it be a little more elegant? I mean, couldn't it have done something? I mean, couldn't it? No. Angelina Jolie or something? No. I got robbed in the process. Anyway. And the funny thing was, it did to my body the thing it had always done, but my mind was on fire. Because I can't live this lie forever. And that's the thing about... That's the thing why Bill wants me to talk about this right away, to discuss this with another person immediately. It's because I don't have the ability, in the middle of a spiritual program, to hold onto a lie like that. You know? The most corrosive thing I've ever done in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous was that lie. And it almost killed me because 2 years later, when the ex-wife wanted to become an ex-wife, I wanted to kill myself. Stone cold sober, money in the bank, couple of houses. The outside of my life looked like you wanted to have my life. Expensive suits, you know, the whole nine yards. I looked like the American dream on the outside, but all I wanted to do was suck on the end of my pistol. That's all I wanted to do. Because that lie that I held on to, which I can't tell you how many people have gone out at 90 days. If you think about it, that's more, for a guy like me, that's more the routine than it is to stay continuously sober coming out of rehab, you know? But I thought it was the end of the world. I thought it was the thing I could never talk about. And it almost killed me. And I don't understand, you know, I don't understand why that, you know, why along the way it could never be different. My ego, for some reason, doesn't have a desire to live. My ego is quite happy seeing me pass away long before my time. You know, when I started doing an aggressive, and I call it aggressive in a spiritual manner, nightly and morning review in 2009 on my way to finding God, finally in these rooms, came back in 2004 and knew at year five. If you're sitting here and you're wondering what's missing from your program, like if people piss you off in meetings or everyone goes, oh, isn't he nice? And you're going, I hate him, right? There may be something wrong in sobriety, right? You don't know. In my case, at 5 years, I'm going, shit, everything in my life is good again, and I am just unhappy. And I had to take a long, hard look at like what was missing. And what was missing for me was the idea of God, because I never wanted to get God. I wasn't going to get God. I wasn't going to get your God. I can guarantee you that, because I could always find fault with your God. But I was not going to even go on the journey, right? The idea of getting God was reprehensible to me because that just somehow seemed weak. And I thought to myself, well, maybe that's the one thing you need to do, Dave, is to get God, right? And on that two-year, walkabout, so to speak, the 11th step became the single most important tool in my box. It became the thing that kind of carried me through. When I work with people now, all these things are so evident to me. You talk to somebody and you find out. I was talking to somebody today that they're new and I'm working with her and she's telling me this thing. And I said, that's cool. I said, if that's how you want to live your life, right? And she said to me, she goes, yeah, that's how I want to live my life. And it suddenly struck her that every moment that we have right now is part of that continuum. Every moment of a spiritual awakening, right, can either be an event where I'm happy, joyous, and free, right? I am not the old alcoholic self, right? Or it can be my ego telling me to hold on to one little shred of something in the past. Maybe it's a little lie. Or maybe it's a desire to hate somebody, Or maybe it's a desire to say, well, that meeting's no good, as if God ever made a meeting that wasn't good. Or that you've got to have strong sponsorship, or that strong sponsorship doesn't work. Or you've got to be a big book person. Well, that big book thing is too Taliban for me, right? Or you should just go to open discussion meetings, or they're terrible, right? This whole idea that I hold on to, right, without any opportunity to grow in effectiveness, right? When I always pray before a meeting for God to let me know what I'm supposed to do, because I'm the only one who doesn't listen, so I'm really praying for me to listen. And I started to think about this lie that I told, right? That I didn't use it 90 days because I was afraid. And I thought about all the ramifications. Between 1985 and 2004, when I came back in these rooms, I wanted to kill myself. When the gift was right here and right now, right? The gift of being alive was right here and right now. And it came as an outgrowth of the 11th step in my journey to find God between 2009 and 2011, right? But in 2004, I wanted to die, right? That is what a little lie does to a guy like me. Now, I can't tell you how many times I've talked about this from the podium, trying to hold on to that secret for 17 years, to have somebody come up to me afterwards and say, I got to talk to you about something. And I'd be like, okay, let's talk, right? I don't have to die today, and neither do you. And it's funny, Chris was talking about the original manuscript and how how this really is a reflection, right, on what the old gangsters, the OG alcoholics were trying to impart to us. And you'll hear me say this multiple times because we're in the old in the original manuscript, that if you get a chance and you have any interest whatsoever in the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, buy Not God by Ernest Clinton and read it. Because he talks in depth about how the big book came about. And he goes through the big book. He goes through the process that Bill and Dr. Bob went through. And Bill and Dr. Bob were these wonderful barbells. Like, Dr. Bob was like, just go to a meeting, and get somebody and get them on their knees and get them to say that what we call the third step prayer now and then make them go out and make amends, right? And Bill was like, well, let's think about this. He was an intellectual. And it was the perfect mix for us, wasn't it? Right? Because we all know we got to run around and be useful to other people, right? Why else would we do this? So sit around and watch Netflix and eat ice cream, No, it's not a bad thing either. But, and they communicated back and forth by letter, sometimes three times a week. It's in the Akron archives, right? And this is the thing that gelled to become this original manuscript, right? And for me, it's this kind of perfect collection of directions for me to go through. And at night, I'll do a nightly review, and I don't do it every night. I would love to tell you I am that perfect, right? And I know you all think I am that perfect, but I'm not, right? And there has been a period in the last couple of years where I put it aside for over a year. I'm back to it now on a semi-regular basis. But there's only 12 words I look for that I write inventory on night when I do my nightly review. And I tend to do it now, because I'm not on New Jersey Transit anymore, I tend to do it at night before I put my head down. Right? and the words I look for, and there's 12 of them, resentful, selfish, dishonest, afraid, apology, secret, kind and loving, better, ourselves, others, pack, and drift. And I can write something as simple as yes or no, maybe, right? If I find myself writing about a resentment and it's there for more than a day, like Chris said, it's not just a little bit of upset, right? It'll eventually end up in a four-column inventory, right? I don't have a choice because I don't want to go back to that guy who, after 19 years, separated from the life that I led, wants to stick a gun in his mouth. I'm not going to dishonor this gift like that. So the question now is now presented to us is, what are we going to do, right, when we move out through this world? And, if you have a family, especially if you have a young family at home, you know that many times you have responsibility to others, right, that are your children, right? If you have a business where people work, you have a responsibility to them. How do I carry the message of God into my life in those areas? So, on awakening, let's think about the 24 hours ahead. We consider the plans for the day. Before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking. There are three prayers you'll find in this section. Especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonesty, or self-seeking motives. Under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance. For after all, God gave us brains to use. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. Now, what the heck is a thought life? You ever ask yourself that question? You ever read this book and go, what the hell is a thought life? Because I do a lot of thinking, and it's not usually productive, right? But if you look back on the time in America, what thought life meant, it was prayer life, right? That's Bill just calling it a different thing. You know, back in 1939 when he was writing this book, 80% of America went to church on Sundays. 80%. And it was a very big part of our life. And the thing that I like about this particular paragraph on awakening is the fact that it recognizes something that took for me a long time, right, to understand. And that is, I lack power, right? When I finally made a decision in Alcoholics Anonymous that I wanted to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and actually do this deal, right? I made a decision that God was everything, right? That doesn't mean that I'm nothing. That means that God is everything. And God has all power, and I have no power, right? If I have no power, then how the hell do I drink coffee, right? Because I've seen myself drink a lot of coffee, right? How does that happen, right? So it had me looking long and hard at the idea of what are the gifts that God gave me? The gift of thought, the gift of my mind, the gift of movement. I have two hands, I have two feet, I can move through this life. I can make rational decisions about who I'm going to hang out with, what I'm going to do, how I'm going to treat people. But all this stuff comes from this idea that I've been given gifts in my life, right, that are not of my own making but of God's making, right? So the question I ask myself in the morning when I go into prayer and meditation is, how can I use the gifts that have been given to me, right, to go out into this world and be of use to other people? Right? Because the idea that I have some self-made abilities is not true. Because that always leads me to pride, and things that lead me to pride always lead me to trouble. And I'm actually going to stop there and turn it over to Chris or open it up.
I just got one short thing to share. Constructive reflection or constructive self-assessment is absolutely vital. We find that our character defects really lay up our alcoholism. The solution to alcoholism is practicing life along spiritual lines, living life along spiritual lines. That's really the solution to alcoholism. And you could not do that without trying to get an accurate appraisal of where you're falling short. And I'll tell one story that kind of relates to this. Now, how many people out there have tried to help us with our alcoholism? And many, many times they just didn't really understand the problem. They saw the alcohol as the problem, and if we would just stop drinking it, everything would be fine. But we know that it's a deeper problem. That, you know, alcohol is a symptom. There's a deeper problem. Our spirit is broken. And we really need to be able to help an alcoholic. It helps to be an alcoholic and to understand what the problem is. Now, the story starts where a couple of civilians walk into a bar. They're just going to have a sandwich and a beer. And they look over, and there's this guy slumped over the bar. He's like passed out on the bar. And they're like, wow, you know, we could help him. So they go up to the bartender, and they say, hey, you want us to take this guy home for you? You know, get him out of here. The bartender's, please. So they reach into his pocket, and they find his wallet, and they find his address, you know, and they put the wallet back. And they hitch him up. He's like semi-conscious. They hitch him up, and they start walking him out, and bam, he falls down. He falls down pretty hard. They get him back up. You know, they make it another five steps or so. Bam, the guy falls down again really hard. They take him outside, and they're walking him to their car, and he goes down again a couple of more times. They drive him across town, and they find the address. And they're getting him out of the car, and they're gonna bring him to his front door. And three more times the guy goes down in between the car and the front door. Finally, they got him up. They got him propped up, and they knock on the door. And you know, his wife comes to the door. And they explain, you know, he was at the bar. I guess he got overserved. And, you know, we're just trying to help him out. And, you know, we're just trying to bring him home. And she goes, oh, thank you. And she's, like, looking behind him like this. She goes, where's his wheelchair? Right? Now, this is just, there's a point to this, right? Like, don't we need to know what the real problem is to be able to help the alcoholic? You know, we can't go in there with not understanding the enormity of the problem. So with that, we could open it up if you want, Dave. You want to open it up?
No, I think we should.
Okay.
What do you think?
I think we should.
Okay.